and flips her long hair over her shoulders. "Here it comes," Gwen thinks. "That attorney, David Paley. What about him?" Gwen's voice comes out more sharply than she intended. "Did you sleep with him?" "Actually, yes, I did." She turns and glares at Riley. "Why? Is that a problem? I'm a grown-up. I don't recall ever having a problem with any of your flings." She zips up her jeans with an angry snap and reaches for a thick sweater. She adds, "God knows there were enough of them." "But you don't know anything about him."
"Yes, I do. He's David Paley, a defense attorney from New York City, and a very nice man."
She can't help adding, "And we're good together." "Gwen, sit down for a minute," Riley says, sitting down on her bed. Gwen slumps down tiredly on the bed across from Riley and starts pulling on warm socks. She refuses to look at her, to show that she is listening. She doesn't want to listen. Riley should mind her own business. How quickly things have changed this weekend. She was supposed to be taking care of Riley, but somehow Riley is trying to reestablish herself in the role of her protector. Gwen doesn't like it.
"I don't know what it is, but something about him is bothering me," Riley says, clearly tense.
Gwen looks up at her and says, in a voice that shows she means it,
"Riley, I don't want to hear it."
Riley bites her tongue and finishes getting dressed in silence. David returns to his room briefly to dress. His mind is racing. So much has happened in such a short time, meeting Gwen, now this awful accident, that looks like it might not be an accident. He's learned to trust his instincts after all these years as a criminal lawyer, and he knows it's not actually that easy to die from a fall down a flight of stairs, unless the neck is broken. And he's pretty sure Dana's neck was not broken. He thinks the cause of death was the blow to the head. And to die from a blow to the head from falling down the stairs, you have to fall in a particular way. You have to strike your head hard against the newel post, for instance. But it seems to him that she struck her head hard against the edge of the bottom step in a peculiar way. It doesn't look like an accident at all. It looks to him like murder. Matthew, simply as the dead woman's fiancé, is the most obvious suspect. David considers Matthew's reaction. Either it was completely genuine, or Matthew is a very good actor. David knows better than to underestimate anyone. He knows that people are complicated. Life is complicated. His own life is complicated. He'd intended to stay away from Gwen once he learned that her friend Riley had been a journalist with the New York Times. He didn't need the trouble. But then she'd sought him out in the library, and it was the most pleasant evening he spent in years. It seemed so natural, so right, when she came upstairs with him. He unlocked the door and closed it behind them, and then it was inevitable. Somehow they'd found the bed. He'd felt himself come alive after years of being alone. He somehow sensed that she felt the same way. He's been so lonely since his wife died. Saturday, 6:55 a.m. Beverly follows her husband to the staircase. They've hastily thrown on some warm clothes and are on their way to the dining room. Her heart races in time with her quick footsteps on the stairs. Despite her deep pity for the dead woman, she almost feels like they have been saved. This crisis has sidelined their own troubles. It's as if they've both been pulled back from the brink they'd faced last night. It's awful to think so, but she's hoping that it will prevent them from focusing again on their marriage in the cold, empty light of day. She does not want to go there, now that she knows just how precarious her position is. And then, when they are home again, with all this drama and tragedy behind them, they will slip into old patterns, avoiding what's important
carrying on the way they should, the way they must. She's a little surprised at how, even in the face of something as calamitous as a young woman's unexpected death, she still considers her own interests first. But then, she didn't really know her. She suspects Henry is grateful to have something to distract them from themselves this weekend, too, rather than spending it arguing with his wife and blowing his comfortable existence apart. They arrive at the landing, and she recoils when she sees the body still lying at the bottom of the stairs, covered by the sheet. She hadn't expected it to be there. Why haven't they moved her, taken her away somewhere, where they don't have to see her? She shudders involuntarily. They make their appalled way down and step around the corpse, deliberately looking elsewhere, and hurry to the dining room. When she and Henry enter the dining room, everyone turns toward them. Lauren is standing by the coffee station, pouring herself a cup from a carafe. Beside her is her boyfriend, Ian, who for once isn't smiling. Gwen is standing by herself, but Riley is hovering nearby. Beverly doesn't see Matthew anywhere. The woman writer, Candace, is off in a corner by herself, drinking coffee and observing everyone with a sharp eye. She's not hiding behind a magazine this morning. The attorney stands quietly away from everyone else, looking troubled and sipping coffee. Candace walks up closer to everyone near the coffee station and says, quietly, "Are any of you aware of who Matthew Hutchinson is?" The rest of them look at her in surprise. "No, he's from one of the most prominent and wealthy families in New England." Beverly had no idea, and looking around at the others, it seems that nobody else had any idea either. At that moment, Bradley brings out plates of rolls, croissants, and muffins from the kitchen. He sets them down on the long side table where the buffet had been laid out the night before. "Please, help yourselves," he says. Bradley seems quite different this morning, Beverly thinks. He has a distracted air, and he's missing his charming smile. Well, no wonder. He glances around the room and says, "I'm really sorry about the power. There's not much we can do about it, but wait for them to fix the lines. I'm sure they're working on it. We'll try to make you as comfortable as possible in the meantime." Beverly is relieved that Matthew isn't there. He must have returned to his room. She imagines the others must feel as relieved as she does. No one would know how to act around him. A handsome young man in the prime of life, evidently the heir to a great fortune, engaged to such a lovely young woman, his happiness destroyed in an instant by this terrible, tragic accident. How sad and difficult the weekend will be, tiptoeing around his grief. She wishes now, her own marriage hanging in tatters, that she'd never heard of this place. If only they could leave. She wants nothing more than to go home. She wants to go home with Henry and patch things up and carry on as normal. The guests mill about awkwardly. Some step up and reach uneasily for croissants and muffins. Bradley soon returns carrying a big platter of eggs. "Fortunately, we have a gas stove," he says. He places the platter on the table and invites everyone to dig in, but many of them seem to have lost their appetite. Finally, James appears from the kitchen and says, with appropriate solemnity, "This is such an awful thing to have happened. I'm so sorry. And," he hesitates, "I apologize, but unfortunately, I've been advised that we must leave the body where it is for the time being." The guests shift uneasily where they stand. "Advised by whom?" Henry asks. "By me," David answers.
"Are you sure you can't move her?" Beverly asks, dismayed.
It seems awful just to leave her there. Disrespectful somehow. "And no, we can't." "Why not? Surely it was an accident," Lauren says.
"Better to wait for the coroner to determine that," David says.
You're not suggesting it wasn't an accident, Gwen says.
I'm saying it's for the coroner to decide.
Suddenly, Beverly wonders if the attorney suspects Matthew of pushing his fiancée down the stairs. She studies the others. She's pretty sure one or two of them just had the same thought.
With a sick feeling in the pit of her stomach, she wonders if any of them heard what she heard, the argument between Matthew and Dana late last night. Should she say anything? Surely it was just a lover's quarrel. Matthew wouldn't harm Dana. They seemed so in love.
There's an awkward silence, and then Riley says abruptly, I thought I heard a scream last night.
When?
David asks.
I don't know. I thought I'd imagined it. Did anyone else hear anything?
David asks, looking around the room. Beverly feels her whole body tighten. She doesn't want to get the young man into trouble if he hasn't done anything wrong. Perhaps someone else heard them arguing. She doesn't want to be the one to tell. But no one else offers anything. She looks down, uncertain, and lets the moment pass.
What about the police?
Henry asks now.
James speaks up. As you know, the power's out and the phones are dead. We haven't been able to reach the police.
I know, but what about snowmobiles?
Henry asks. James shakes his head.
We don't have them here. They're noisy. We like to focus on nature, hiking, skiing, snowshoeing. We're old-fashioned.
Henry rolls his eyes in disgust.
I can't believe you don't have a generator,
he mutters.
The police will get here eventually,
James says, ignoring him.
Once the power's restored and we can use the phone, or they clear and sand the roads and we can get out.
How long does it usually take, Riley asks uneasily, to restore power up here when there's a storm?
Bradley says, it all depends, but I imagine it's a pretty widespread outage. Ice is much worse than snow. It brings down the wires.
Until the police do get here, the attorney says, we have to treat it as a possible crime scene.
But, Beverly begins and stops, as all eyes turn her way and she flushes. She says, pointing out the obvious, we'll have to step past her body every time we go up or down the stairs. We'll see her lying there whenever we sit in the lobby. And then she thinks of that poor young man up in his room, waiting for the police, and whether she ought to say something about what she heard.
Chapter 10, Saturday, 7:45 a.m. Candace lingers in the dining room with the others after breakfast. It seems like nobody knows what to do. They are all at loose ends now, with the exception of the lawyer, who leaves the dining room after breakfast with a subdued but purposeful air. Candace notices the dark-haired woman, whose name she's learned is Gwen, watching him go. She can't have any idea who he is. Candace would love to follow the notorious David Paley up the stairs. She'd bet dollars to donuts he's on his way to see Matthew Hutchinson, and she wishes more than anything that she could be there to hear what is said. Then she reminds herself not to be despicable, that the man has just lost the woman he was to marry. This is something she has had to work on, not letting her curiosity trump her compassion. That's why she got out of journalism, after all, and started writing books instead. Long-form nonfiction had saved her from that, at least. When she writes a book, she finds she can still feel for her subject, still find her sense of decency. Journalism can ruin you. She glances at Riley, whom she recognized the night before as a war correspondent for the New York Times. She's got the look. Not the look of the hardened journalist who has necessarily grown a thick, protective skin. She's at the other end of the scale. She's broken wide open, raw. She wonders if Riley will ever be put back together again. She can recognize PTSD when she sees it. She's seen it before. She's glad she's no longer a journalist. Still, there's a body lying at the foot of the stairs, and no one knows how it got there. She can read people pretty well, and she's not stupid. The attorney looks as if he suspects it was more than an accident. She's tempted to slip upstairs and listen outside Matthew's door, but she restrains herself.
"We can't go out in this,"
Henry says gloomily, interrupting her thoughts. He's scowling outside at the ice. The dining room windows give onto the forest on the east side of the hotel. Everything is covered in sparkling ice. It's beautiful, as if the world is coated in diamonds. Long, pointy icicles hang from the eaves in front of the windows. They look rather deadly. If you were walking under one of those and it fell on you, it might kill you, Candace thinks. The storm has made it too dangerous for walking, or skiing, or snowshoeing, or anything but taking your life in your hands. The best place to be during a major ice storm is safely inside, where you can't get hit by falling branches, or pierced through with icicles, or electrocuted by fallen power lines. Not to mention the risk of slipping and cracking your head open on the ice. "No, thank you," Candace thinks. She's going to stay inside like everybody else. David knocks on the door of Matthew's room. When there's no answer, he tries again, more loudly this time. Finally, with nervous hands, he fumbles for the key he obtained from James and opens the door himself, afraid that Matthew might have done something drastic. He's seen it before. He pushes the door open quickly and spies Matthew, sitting immobile in a chair in front of the fireplace. David's immediate relief shifts to uneasiness. Even though James had started a fire earlier, the room is chilly. David steps farther into the room. No wonder. Matthew has let the fire almost go out. David approaches and studies Matthew carefully. He's obviously been weeping. His eyes and face are puffy. He looks almost catatonic. "Matthew," David says. The other man does not respond. It's hard to tell if he's swamped with grief or guilt, or quite possibly both at once. Quietly, David moves over to the fireplace and sets the fire screen aside. He chooses another log and carefully adds it to the fire, poking and prodding to make a catch. It's good to have something like this to do while he thinks about what to say. He wishes he could just keep poking and prodding the fire forever, staring into the flames, and not have to do what he's about to do. But he's worried about this young man. He feels a responsibility. He would like to help if he can, even though there is not much to be done. You can't go back in time and change things. He's just cleanup crew, really. Finally, he sets the poker aside, replaces the fire screen, and takes the other chair beside Matthew. He pauses while he decides how to begin.
"The police will get here eventually," he says at last in a low voice. "If not today, then tomorrow. They will investigate. There will be an inquest into the cause of death."
He pauses. He knows to speak slowly. The mind in shock has trouble taking things in.
"It is my belief that they will not find the cause of death to be an accidental fall."
He waits. Matthew doesn't stir, doesn't even show surprise, which is troubling.
"It appears to me that the injury to the head, which was most likely the cause of death, is not one that would naturally occur in a fall. It looks like it was caused by being pushed into the edge of the stair from the front and above."
He can't help himself. The cynicism takes over.
"If you're trying to make a murder look like an accident in a fall down the stairs, far better to push the head into the newel post in the direction of the fall."
That gets his attention. "What did you say?" Matthew asks, lifting his head
and looking at him for the first time. David looks into his eyes.
I said, it doesn't look like an accident. It looks like your fiancé was murdered.
What?
I believe Dana was murdered.
Matthew looks back at him as if it's finally dawning on him.
Oh, God.
No. I believe so. Yes.
A long moment passes, and then Matthew says, you think I did it?
I don't know, and I don't want to know, but I am a criminal defense attorney, and I am here to offer you some free advice until you can retain an attorney of your own.
I didn't kill her.
Okay.
I was asleep, I swear. I didn't even know she'd left the room. Why would she do that? She's never left our hotel room before. The bathroom is right here. She's not a sleepwalker.
And that's just it. Why would she leave the room, David thinks, unless she'd argued with her fiancé?
And then perhaps he followed her in a rage, lost control for a fatal moment. He doesn't want to ask. He doesn't want to get involved, but he does.
Did you two have an argument last night?
What? No, of course not. I love her. I could never hurt her.
His voice has risen, and he lowers it again. There must be some reason she left. Maybe she heard something out in the hall. I don't know. All I know is that I slept through all of it.
You had no disagreements about anything? About money? A prenup, perhaps?
Matthew shakes his head dismissively. No, neither of us wanted or needed a prenup. We were in love. That's the truth.
He asks desperately,
do you really think someone killed her?
It looks that way to me,
David says. Matthew turns back to stare at the fire, fresh tears spilling from his eyes.
Dear God.
He covers his face with his hands for a moment until he regains control. Then he removes them and turns to David.
If someone deliberately killed her, then I want to know who. And I want to know why.
He looks back at David.
It wasn't me. I swear.
He is clearly tormented. David observes Matthew shrewdly. He's almost convinced the man is innocent.
Okay. But here's my advice anyway. Don't say anything to anybody about this. Just say nothing. It may not be a bad idea to stay up here in your room until the police get here. And when they do get here, if they caution you and arrest you, and even if they don't, say nothing. Get yourself a good attorney.
Matthew has turned even paler. What about you?
I don't think so, but I can recommend someone if you like.
David gets up to leave. He knows that with no phone service, there's no one that Matthew can call, no one he can talk to. He's isolated here.
Are you going to be okay?
I don't know.
I'm here if you need me,
he says. He means it.
I'll check in on you again in a bit.
Matthew nods and turns back to the fire. David lets himself out. Matthew hears the door click closed and turns to look. He's alone again. He stands up suddenly and begins to pace. He's overcome with grief for Dana, but he's also frightened and agitated by what David Paley has said. Dana is dead, and the attorney thinks he did it. If he thinks so, the police will think so too. He suppresses a sob as he paces the room. He told the attorney that he and Dana hadn't argued, and now he thinks he's made a mistake. He and Dana had argued. Tension about the impending wedding erupting out of nowhere. They've both been under a lot of stress. Dana had brought up his mother again, complaining that his mother has never approved of her, never thought she was good enough. Dana got like that sometimes, more often recently, emotionally overwrought, a little insecure. Looking at her, you would never be able to tell that sometimes she lacked confidence. But occasionally, she revealed it to him. It didn't bother him.
He was used to people, friends and girlfriends, being intimidated by his wealthy, powerful family. He denied it, of course, said that she was being oversensitive, that of course his mother approved of her. But he was tired of having to say the same thing over and over, especially because it wasn't exactly true. His mother did think he could do better, and she'd had the audacity to tell him so on more than one occasion. She tried to get him to wait, thinking he would tire of Dana, thinking that he was simply taken in by Dana's beauty and that his feelings for her would change. He'd made it clear to his strong-willed, wealthy matriarch of a mother that he loved Dana and that he was going to marry her. But it was wearying to be constantly caught between the two women, unable to entirely please or appease either one of them. Last night, his exasperation had gotten the better of him. He wonders suddenly if anyone heard them arguing. Chapter 11. Saturday, 8 a.m. The guests filter slowly from the dining room into the lobby, subdued, avoiding the staircase, some of them still holding coffee cups. Henry is cursing his luck. If only the snow had not turned to driving ice in the night, this would have been a rather fabulous winter wonderland. He could have gone cross-country skiing all day, worked off some of this god-awful tension. Now he stands close to the front windows of the lobby and looks gloomily out at the ice, coating everything like glass, and feels cheated. This hotel isn't exactly cheap, and everything seems to be conspiring to make him have a miserable time. He makes the mistake of glancing at his wife, who is watching him. He feels so restless. He leans forward and practically presses his nose against the cool glass of the window. He sees that a massive branch has broken off the enormous old tree on the front lawn and lies shattered in pieces, dark wood against sparkling white. He feels his wife come up behind him, hears her say, "You aren't thinking of going out in that." He hadn't been, but now she's decided it. "Yes. Don't be ridiculous," she says, as if scolding one of the kids for some harebrained idea. He moves over to the coat stand near the door where most of them had left their coats the night before, their boots below them on the mat. He finds and pulls on his winter jacket, bends over and slips off his running shoes, and pulls on the winter boots that he arrived in.
"Are you sure that's a good idea?" Ian says, but without the overlay of hysteria and the need for control Henry detects so frequently in his wife's voice. "I won't go far," he tells Ian, pulling on his hat. "I just want to get some fresh air." "Make sure you stay away from any power lines," Ian advises him.
They're all standing watching him, as if he's some kind of canary, testing the conditions. Henry turns around and opens the front door. He feels the cold air hit his face and everyone's eyes on his back. He steps out onto the porch and pulls the door closed behind him. It's now that he notices the wind, how wild and loud it is. From inside the hotel, it sounds like a constant, dull roar with the occasional shriek, something far away. But out here, it's alive. It's a monster, and it's much closer. He looks toward the forest at the edge of the lawn and sees how the wind is whipping the tops of the trees back and forth. And the noise, it's like a keening. Worst of all is the creaking, sawing sound as the wind brings its force to bear on the ice-laden branches of the tree in front of him. He closes his eyes for a moment and listens. He imagines that this is what an old wooden sailing ship might have sounded like at sea, in a storm. Then he opens his eyes and lifts them up to the tree, wondering if any more branches are about to come down. He's been still now for some moments, and he knows they're all watching. He grabs the porch handrail and looks down. There's a thick coating of ice on the wooden stairs, and he steps carefully, holding on firmly to the rail.
It's very slippery, but he makes it to the bottom of the three steps without incident and stands there. He's beginning to wonder what he's doing out here. He starts walking, not walking, walking is impossible, but sliding his feet along the ice, trying to keep his center of balance low. It's like walking after Teddy on the ice rink at hockey when he was little, just after the rink was flooded, only the rink was flat, and this ice slopes all over the place. Without warning, Henry's feet go right out from under him in spectacular fashion, and he lands heavily on his back, winded, not 20 feet from the front porch. He lies there, trying to get his breath back, wheezing loudly, looking up at the clouds, feeling like a fool. He hears the front door open behind him. That will be his wife, telling him to come back in. But before she can say anything, there's a frightful cracking sound overhead. He turns his head toward the tree. His heart jumps in his chest as he realizes what's going to happen. He closes his eyes as part of a branch comes down and lands with a shudder no more than a few feet away. He slowly reopens his eyes. That branch could have killed him. Unable to get back up on his feet, Henry crawls and slides on all fours back to the front porch and then hauls himself to standing at the front steps using the handrail. The front door is wide open, and everyone is looking at him, alarmed. They practically pull him back inside the hotel. Once he's regained his composure, his wife says, "If you want something to do, you can go help Bradley try to clear the walk out to the ice house." He looks back at her in annoyance, and she adds, "He told me there aren't any trees there. It should be relatively safe." Candace feels rather sorry for Henry, who is clearly frustrated at being trapped here. Most of them seem to feel that way, either longing to get out, like Henry, or hanging listlessly about, like Ian and Lauren. She's got plenty to do, as long as her battery holds up, and plenty here to interest her. She wanders over to Dana's body to have another look. She can feel the other's eyes on her, disapproving as she lifts the sheet. This time, she looks more carefully at the head injury, and then at the blood on the stair, and her heart beats a little faster at what she sees. Then she wanders back to the fireplace and stands in front of it for a moment, lost in thought, warming her hands. She really can't afford to let herself be distracted by this, but she suspects that someone murdered that poor girl. Lauren startles her out of her thoughts by asking, "What kind of book are you working on?" Candace smiles a little evasively. "Oh, I don't like to talk about it. I never talk about what I'm working on until it's finished," she says apologetically. "I find it just sucks all the energy out of the project." "Oh," Lauren says, "I thought writers always liked to talk about what they were working on." "Not me," Candace replies. Gradually, the guests begin to leave the lobby, scattering in different directions, subdued by the tragedy that has occurred in their midst. Bradley had brought a couple of oil lamps and some matches and left them on the coffee table, but most of them opt to use the flashlight app on their iPhones to help them find their way up the dark staircase and around the unlit corridors upstairs. It's unnervingly dark once you leave the first floor, where the windows across the front of the hotel let in daylight. It's time to get to work. Candace skirts the corpse and trudges up the staircase to her room on the third floor. The corridor is lit only by the rather small windows at each end, and it is dark and gloomy, made even more so by the dark carpet and dull wallpaper. Candace supposes that all the bedrooms have windows, hers certainly does, and that if the drapes are pulled back, there will be enough light for most purposes, but probably not enough to read easily. Upstairs, it's colder. The large fire in the lobby makes it undoubtedly the most hospitable place to be, if you are able to ignore the presence of the dead body. But most of the guests seem to have gone back up to their rooms,
badly spooked. Candace finds her room too cold, too gloomy, and too dark for her liking. She returns downstairs carrying her laptop and discovers the library. She searches out Bradley, finds him in the dining room clearing things away, and asks him to build a fire in the library for her. Bradley looks a bit harried and harassed. It must be difficult, Candace thinks, to keep a hotel going while short-staffed during a power failure.
I thought I heard you were shoveling the path to the ice house, she says as they walk to the library.
He smiles at her briefly. Yes, but I've got Henry helping with that now. It's tough going, but he's having some luck with the snowblower.
She follows Bradley into the library. She longs to complain about the awful position the power failure has put her in, but she doesn't want to burden him any further. And she is aware of how petty it would be when there's a young woman dead, and there may be people out there in real jeopardy from this storm. Still, there is no question the power outage is causing her great inconvenience. She came up here to work, and she can't work without a functioning laptop. She has only a few hours of battery left at most. She may be reduced to writing with a ballpoint pen, wrapped in a blanket. It's not what she imagined. She thinks of her mother trapped in her bed and wonders if her sisters are taking care of her the way they should. She settles herself into a comfortable armchair by the crackling, spitting fire, thanks Bradley profusely, and asks him to bring her a hot cup of tea when he gets a chance. Then she opens her computer, but it's a while before she can stop thinking about Dana and get down to work. Saturday, 9:15 a.m. Gwen had found breakfast in the dining room, which she couldn't help comparing unfavorably to the delightful breakfast experience promised to her in the Mitchelson brochure, excruciating. She only managed to eat half a muffin without tasting it. David hadn't approached her, but Riley had been standing beside her, oozing a fierce protectiveness. Or maybe it was because he was distracted by what had happened to Dana. Gwen knew he was concerned about Matthew. She didn't really give a shit what Riley thought, but she hadn't liked the idea of Riley grabbing her arm if she tried to walk over to David and creating a scene. Riley was unpredictable. When David left the dining room, Gwen decided she would find him later when she had the possibility of a little privacy. She couldn't help thinking about him. Just a few hours earlier, he'd been touching her, loving her. They'd wandered out to the lobby and watched Henry make a fool of himself on the icy lawn. Then Riley had suggested the two of them explore the hotel together. Gwen showed her the library. Then they went into the sitting room next to the library. It was quite charming, with an array of plump chintz sofas and chairs and low tables and an oil portrait of a woman over the fireplace. Shall we stay here? Gwen suggested, rubbing her hands along her arms for warmth. But Riley was restless and wanted to keep looking around. They explored the little corridor off the lobby and came to the bar. This is nice, Riley says now, glancing around the bar approvingly. I'll make a fire for us here. Of course she can start her own fire, Gwen thinks, watching her. She's lived in Iraq and Afghanistan in the roughest of conditions. She wonders what else Riley can do that Gwen can't. Drive a standard transmission, treat a wound, protect a source, negotiate with terrorists. She realizes that Riley has never really shared any of these kinds of details with her. She probably thinks Gwen wouldn't be able to handle it. Riley is the strangest collection of impressive skills, fierce bravery, and now a terrible, unpredictable fragility. Gwen is acutely aware of the bottles behind the bar and worries that Riley will want to get into them, even though it's just past breakfast. She turns her back on the bar and wanders around the room, perusing the titles of the books shelved along the walls, studying the paintings. Suddenly, Gwen finds herself thinking about the last year of journalism school when everything changed for her. Riley knows what happened. She was there. She knows why Gwen thinks she doesn't deserve to be happy. But Gwen knows that if she wants a chance with David, she must confront the past. She must face it and come to terms with it somehow. They were out one night at a party. There was a lot of drinking. It was the end of the year, and everybody was tying one on because they would soon be graduating. Gwen witnessed a terrible crime. She watched three men rape a young woman, and she did nothing. Nothing at all. She remembers how she'd been up all the night before, finishing some assignment. She'd had a lot to drink and needed to lie down. She found a bedroom. It was a house party, with a bed and a spare mattress on the floor. She crawled under some blankets on the mattress. Then a girl came crashing into the room, waking her up. It was dark, with only the light from the streetlight outside penetrating the room. Gwen recognized the girl. She was in some of her classes. She was trying to shrug some guy off, but he wasn't having it. He started pulling off her clothes. Gwen was about to get up. She thought the two of them could make him stop, but then two more men came in and closed the door behind them. One of them propped a chair up under the doorknob so no one could open the door. Gwen was paralyzed with fear. The other girl screamed, but the music was so loud no one could have heard her. They held her down on the bed while they raped her. They were laughing. It all happened so fast. She hadn't wanted them to know she was there. She was afraid they would do the same to her. They left the girl there, sobbing on the bed. As soon as they were gone, Gwen threw up. She went over to see how the other girl was, but she'd passed out. Gwen turned her on her side so that she wouldn't choke on her own vomit, and then she went to find Riley. And Riley told her she should have fought back. Riley has told her since then that she doesn't think that anymore. When Gwen found Riley at the party and told her what had happened, they went up to see the girl together. Gwen told her she'd been in the room. The girl didn't say anything, but Gwen could see the reproach in her eyes. She asked Gwen if she would be able to identify the men who raped her and to corroborate her story. She'd told Riley that she thought she'd be able to recognize them, but the minute the girl put her on the spot, Gwen panicked. She didn't want the responsibility. She told her that it was too dark and that she couldn't bear to watch, that she'd hid under the covers, that she wouldn't be able to identify them, that she couldn't help her. The girl wanted to press charges, but she didn't want to do it without Gwen's help. But Gwen didn't help her, even though Riley urged her to. She told her that she couldn't be a witness. She did nothing. She graduated and moved away and tried to forget about it. But she's always been haunted by the thought that those college boys, whoever they were, are now grown men. And if they could behave that way once, they could do it again. She heard that the girl killed herself not long after, and Gwen's been living with the guilt ever since. It has defined her, shaped her life. She's a coward, someone who failed to do the right thing. She knows she no longer deserves any of the good things life has to offer. Riley has always judged her for it. Even now, years later, Riley's generally holier-than-thou attitude infuriates her. She sometimes wonders if Riley did everything she should have done in all those war zones, whether she'd always done everything absolutely fucking morally perfectly. She wonders if Riley ever made a mistake, if she'd ever been afraid all that time in Iraq and Afghanistan. Lost in her thoughts, she suddenly hears Riley suck in her breath with a loud gasp. She turns, startled, and sees Riley in the chair in front of the fire, her face drained of color. "Oh, no," Riley says. "What?" Gwen's alarmed at the visible change in Riley. "Are you all right?" I knew I'd heard his name before.
Gwen turns away uneasily.
Come over here. Listen to me.
Gwen looks at her warily and reluctantly goes and sits across from her.
I've just remembered who he is.
She leans forward and looks at Gwen intensely, genuine concern on her face. Now Gwen is starting to worry. Surely there's nothing wrong with David. There can't be.
Riley says, he's the attorney who was arrested on suspicion of murdering his wife.
Chapter 12. Saturday, 10 a.m. James scrubs the frying pan in the big kitchen sink and ponders how to rejig things so that he can feed his guests adequately without any electricity. The refrigerator isn't working. At least he can cook with the gas oven. But he's without a dishwasher. Breakfast was easy enough. Eggs and pastries. And nobody much felt like eating anyway, from what he could see, after that poor girl fell down the stairs. He's lost his appetite, too. He feels terrible for that man's loss. And the whole thing makes him sick with anxiety. It's the kind of situation every hotel owner loses sleep over. An accident in his hotel. A fatal accident at that. He has insurance. But Christ, what a thing to happen. He knows he's not to blame. His carpets aren't loose. He'd gone up to the landing and checked over that carpet himself the first chance he got. It was fine. She must have stumbled for no reason. There's absolutely no way anyone can blame him or his hotel. He thinks again about how much she might have had to drink the night before. He'd asked Bradley in the kitchen earlier when they were preparing breakfast.
Do you think she was drunk?
He asked him in a low voice.
Do you think that's why she fell?
Bradley shook his head. Don't worry, Dad. She wasn't drunk. I was serving, remember?
But I had you put that bottle of champagne in their room, remember? Do you know if they drank it?
Bradley shook his head again.
I don't know. I haven't been in there this morning. David didn't want me in there.
James chewed his lip, something he does when he's worried, a habit he's been trying to break. He hadn't looked for the champagne bottle when he was in the room, hadn't thought of it.
Dad, don't worry, Bradley repeated firmly. You have nothing to worry about. She didn't fall because she'd been drinking.
But James couldn't help noticing that Bradley also seemed shaken by what had happened. He looked tired. There were rings under his eyes, as if he hadn't slept.
Were you up late last night?
James asked.
No, Bradley said, picking up the trays. I need to take these out.
Then he'd taken the muffins and croissants out to the dining room. James finishes with his frying pan and puts it on the drying rack. He wishes the power would come back on. He misses his bloody dishwasher. He wishes the police would get here and take the body away. He can't believe he's got to take care of almost a dozen people without electricity, and that there's a dead body at the foot of the grand staircase in his beloved hotel, and he can't do anything about it. Saturday, noon. Lauren descends the staircase into the lobby, stepping with distaste around Dana's body, Ian right behind her. It's a rather horrible choice they all have to make, whether to use the creepy back staircase or the main one with the body at the bottom. When she looks up, the lobby is empty except for Candace, who hurriedly puts a book down on a side table and turns to face her. It's Lauren's book.
That's mine, Lauren says. I thought I'd left that book down here.
Candace asks, do you know where Bradley is? I came out to ask him to bring me some hot tea.
I can tell him if I see him if you like, Lauren says.
Oh, would you? And tell him to bring my lunch to the library. Thanks. I didn't really want to bother his father in the kitchen. Candace hurries away. Lauren watches her go. She sits down on the hearth of the lobby's big stone fireplace and pulls Ian down beside her
trying to warm up while they wait for the others to appear and for lunch to be served. Lauren stares across the room at the front windows. She can't stop thinking about it. Dana is dead at the foot of the stairs. She avoids looking in that direction as best she can.
"This is so terrible,"
she whispers to Ian.
"I know,"
he agrees beside her. He takes her hand, clasps it in his own.
"I don't know what I'd do if something happened to you."
She lightly kisses his cheek. Then she whispers,
"I don't see why she can't be moved. Why do we have to wait for the coroner?"
"It's awful to leave her lying there,"
Ian agrees.
"Do you think someone might have pushed her?"
Lauren whispers.
"No, of course not. It must have been an accident. David's an attorney. He's just following procedure."
He adds, pushing a strand of her hair behind her ear, "Lawyers always think they know everything." He glances over his shoulder at the body and says,
"But if the police don't get here soon, surely we can't just leave her there. It's too creepy."
One by one, the guests reappear in the lobby, as if summoned by an invisible bell. Hungry, no doubt, David thinks, wondering what there is to eat. After speaking to Matthew, David had spent the morning in his room, thinking about Dana at the bottom of the stairs, about how it might have happened, thinking about the bereft young man holed up in his room, waiting for the inevitable visit by the police, thinking about Gwen, thinking a lot about Gwen. Now, in the lobby, David looks at her. She seems even more distressed than she had earlier that morning at breakfast, and she hasn't turned his way once since he entered the lobby. She's sitting by the fire, holding her hands out to it for warmth, not looking his way. He would like to go to her, but he senses she doesn't want him to. He tries to understand it. She can't be one of those women who enjoy one-night stands but want nothing more. He doesn't think she's the type. He's certain of it. Of course, they're all distressed by the death of Dana. And he doesn't know what her friend Riley might have said to her once they were alone together. Warned her off him, no doubt. He knew it was better not to get involved with any of it. Not with her, and not with Matthew. He's had enough trouble. What he wants now is peace. But he fears that peace might have to wait. Gwen catches David looking at her and averts her eyes. What Riley told her about David, it can't possibly be true. Maybe she's just saying this to restore the balance of power between them to what it was before. Maybe Riley is deliberately sabotaging her. That is what Gwen doesn't know. How easy it would be to do, to warn her to stay away from David all weekend. And then when they get back to civilization and Google David Paley, he probably won't be who she's thinking of at all. The only thing he will have in common with the man who was arrested for murdering his wife is that they are both attorneys. And Riley will just laugh it off. "Oh, I was so sure. Sorry." But it will be too late. Her opportunity with David will be gone. She's already 30, and she might never meet anyone else. She studies Riley resentfully and then turns away. Or maybe it's not deliberate at all. Maybe Riley's paranoia is simply spilling over into everything. Henry is sitting beside his wife, not looking at her. His muscles are pleasantly tired from clearing the path out to the ice house, and he's built up an appetite. Surely lunch will be soon. He can feel Beverly looking sidelong at him. He wonders what they would be doing right now if this hadn't happened. Dismantling their life together bit by bit, he thinks, over cold cups of coffee in some corner of the hotel. He realizes that he is almost glad of the diversion the accident has brought. He thinks about what the attorney said. It's for the coroner to decide. He dips his head down now to his wife and whispers, "Do you think she was pushed?"
She looks back at him, worried.
Beverly answers him anxiously. I don't know.
Should she bring up the argument she overheard between Dana and Matthew?
She tells herself it's none of her business. She's decided to say nothing, at least for the time being. No one ever really knows what goes on in other people's relationships or what another person's relationship is like. Perhaps they quarreled all the time and it means nothing.
She looks now at Henry and realizes that she doesn't actually know what goes through his mind most of the time. She makes assumptions, that's all, and believes they are the truth. All these years, she thought she knew him so well. But did she really? How utterly shocked she'd been last night when he said it was too late for them to fix their marriage. The truth is, she doesn't know what he's thinking at all. Perhaps he has a mistress. It's the first time the thought has occurred to her. Maybe it isn't so hard to believe. She hasn't been that interested in sex for a long time. Perhaps he's found someone else, and that's why he wants to leave her. Otherwise, she doesn't think he'd bother. That's it, she thinks. That must be the reason for this bombshell he's dropped so callously. He can't want to tear their family apart just so that he can be away from her. They're not that bad together. He can't be looking forward to being financially ruined and living alone in some sad apartment, missing his children, just to be away from her. No, there must be someone else. Someone who makes him think that leaving her and the kids is going to be some fun, giddy, sex-soaked adventure. She wonders who it is, whether it's someone she knows. She remembers how annoyed he'd been when he realized there was no Wi-Fi here at the inn. Perhaps he was hoping to be able to stay in touch with his girlfriend. Perhaps she had expected him to stay in touch with her. The girlfriend that Beverly is now afraid actually exists. How quickly and how absolutely trust, built over many years, can collapse. She needs to be sure. She realizes she needs to look at her husband's cell phone, but he always keeps it on him, or at least near him, and she has no idea what his password is. She can't even guess. But she is suddenly certain that if she could get into his cell phone, she would find the truth, and then she would know what she's dealing with. Chapter 13. Lauren watches Henry and his wife Beverly seated side by side. They're barely speaking to one another. Riley and Gwen are sitting far apart. Lauren senses a rift. She has been watching Riley especially. The edge of hysteria that Lauren first noticed when they'd rescued her out of the ditch the night before is still there, amplified even. Riley fidgets endlessly, twirling the silver ring on her index finger, her eyes constantly scanning the room as if looking for something, some threat. Lauren notices that Gwen is ignoring Riley, which is odd. Last night, Gwen had seemed overly solicitous, trying her best to manage Riley's mood, but now she doesn't seem to care. Something must have happened. Lauren remembers last night, noticing the little flirtation between David and Gwen in the dining room coming to an abrupt halt. She wonders if Riley had anything to do with that, and if she did, what her reason might have been. Jealousy, probably. Riley knows Gwen is angry at her, but it had to be done. Riley studies David, watching him, trying to remember what she knows about the case. She's almost certain he's the New York attorney who was arrested and released for the violent murder of his wife 3 or 4 years ago. She tries to recall the details. It was a bludgeoning death, a particularly brutal one. The woman had been so badly beaten that her back was broken. She'd been struck repeatedly in the head with something heavy in the kitchen of their home in one of New York's expensive suburbs. The murder weapon had never been recovered.
The husband claimed that he'd returned home late from work and found her. He'd called 911, but there was some discrepancy about the details.